Margaret, you kept saying at the beginning that there's a need to settle this for once and for all. People didn't want the ongoing discussions around the Constitution. We're 3 months out, the polls are narrowing. Certainly, the expectation of the Yes campaign, the conversations I've had with them, they've designed their strategy for their campaign to peak on the 18th of September. Assuming the No side win, as is reasonable to assume at the minute, it could be a relatively narrow result. So isn't it a little optimistic to think that this is going to settle it? Why do you think that this is not a debate that's going to be revisited year after year?
Let me do something very strange and tell you what Alex Salmond would do, and I'll do exactly what he would do. If he won by one vote, he would say the Scottish people have spoken. So we need to actually respect the decision of the Scottish people. If they vote against separation, we can't allow anybody to misinterpret that. This is a very clear, very emphatic choice people have. It's a binary choice. They either say yes or they say no. If they say no, you have to respect the fact that they're saying no to separation. Now, as
Do you
we've
expect Alex Salmond to respect that?
I think he'll have to. I absolutely think he will have no choice, and neither will anyone else, because I do think that's the way the conversation is developing in Scotland. I suppose I maybe mentioned that quite a lot about settling the matter. Maybe it reflects the fact that in Scotland, this is the conversation. This is what people are talking about. A friend of mine said that it was in a pub about weeks ago, and he went from one end of the pub to the other. I think he's been very naughty, went out for a smoke. And he said he passed about five or six tables. Every single one of those tables, different types of people were talking about the referendum. And it's families are talking about splitting families. There's a bit of it, it's great because people are engaged in politics. There's a bit of it, it's getting a bit divisive. There's a bit of it, people are saying, oh, and we've got 90 days to go. Oh, God, we need to talk about something else. There are other things that really matter. We can't just keep talking about this. If it's a vehicle for talking about those other things, that's great. But I think if people think that's the end of the road, I think there's a level of frustration about it. But, we've had a political debate the length of time I've been involved in politics, which is over 35 years, actually. We've always been, if you say we need to do this, well, independence is the answer, we need to do that, independence is the answer, we need to do that. And I think people are now saying, right, okay, is it or is it not? And if we make our decision, that's it. So I think that's part of it. Can
Okay.
I just say one thing about the polls?
Briefly, because you've
Okay,
spoken
I
for
know.
quite a long time, and I'd like to.
Sorry. The don't knows are important in the polls, and it's where the don't knows are, so that's
Sure.
important. So I'm not trying to disrespect the fact that there are people still making up their minds.
Okay. Owen, you used the word federal. It's a word you've used before. It's a word Gordon Brown has now started using quite a lot. It's a word I think you'd reasonably read into what Carwyn Jones says, though he doesn't use the phrase as much as you do. You've also said Wales is not Scotland, and the asymmetry has been a source of instability. I'm reading from Margaret's document from the Scottish Devolution Commission that she sat on that we believe the model of asymmetrical devolution works well for the UK and the nations within it. How much legs do you think there is still in asymmetry?
Well, you've answered my question already. Wales isn't Scotland, so in Scotland they might have a view that its asymmetry has been fine. My perspective is that I think the asymmetry actually is a boon to those people who want devolution to be a series of steps to an end point that is independence. That's in essence my concern, and therefore if you have a greater degree of symmetry and you have a therefore I think a lesser fuel for those people who are always looking for something else to ratchet up the debate in order to get to their end game, then that will be positive, because I don't think people want endless change and churn. And in Wales, as I said, I don't see any upsurge in interest for independence. There is amongst a set of journalists and, a chattering class, if you like, but out there in the public, it's 10%, same as it always was.
Margaret, Gordon Brown in his most recent speech said, it was a very interesting speech, well worth reading. One of the core tasks of the Union is to secure cross-country fairness through the redistribution of resources. Now, a debate we've been having in Wales for some time is the future of the Barnett formula. In order to help the campaign in Scotland, all the party leaders have committed to keep the ballot formula in Scotland. How do you reconcile that willingness to throw the incentives at the Scots, which obviously hugely advantages you, marginally disadvantages us? But how do
I think you're giving the game away about some of your prejudices.
How so?
Well, I don't think the formula, the funding for Scotland, is throwing things at Scotland, as if, you know...
It advantages to a tune of £4 billion a year and disadvantages us to a tune of something like £300 million a year. So
can I tell you...
That's value-free, that's
this
facts.
Is the kind of frame that I don't like, which is Scotland versus Wales. Yeah. I think we need to actually think about what's in the best interest of our respective nations. I think that's a healthier framework to look at things.
OK, well, that's what the economic analysis done for the Welsh Government has shown, is that the public spending is more generous to Scotland than it is to Wales. And it's been very difficult to get that issue addressed. You know, Owen has said time and again that the UK government needs to address that, but there hasn't been a clear Labour commitment to do that I've caught.
I think there has been. So I think you're misrepresenting us, Lee. We've said very explicitly that we recognise that there is an issue with convergence, and the issue is, you know, this it's not incredibly complicated. This is it. You know, we know a barn at work. It's a factor of population versus public spending, and the way in which those things have moved respectively has meant that Wales has seen convergence, i.e. reduction in the amount of money we got, between 300 million and now about 150 million. So it's gone down over the last couple of years as the amount of spending in England has gone down. And I think we've got to address that. And Margaret said that, Ed Miliband said that, Ed Balls has said that, and we will need to come up with a way in which we do that. But that shouldn't be at the expense of Scotland, because this isn't about set in Wales versus Scotland. And, you know, frankly, I'm not sure I buy the notion that Scotland is dramatically overfunded. I think if you had a different needs-based formula that might look at rurality and sparsity and relative health in Scotland and demographics in Scotland, you might find a very different conclusion drawn from that. I just don't think it's a helpful frame for us, and it is about dividing us one from another, and it is about setting one people against another. What is true in both instances is that both Scotland and Wales are subsidised by England, as are other parts of England who get greater funding. So London, for example, because of its hardship in certain areas, you know, London isn't all the city, Tower Hamlets isn't West Kensington, also gets a greater degree of subsidy than the southeast area around it. And we've got to be, I think, grown up about this. But it does need to be modernised, it does need to be looked at. And from Wales's perspective, I think we've been very clear that we will look at it.
Can you say more what that means?
Well, I think I've said it, am I really, that we will need to amend somehow the funding arrangements for Wales in order to make sure that in future there isn't convergence that leads to a reduction in the amount of money. But to be honest, I think that's small beer in many respects, versus the much bigger picture I was talking about a minute ago, in terms of the much bigger set of priorities and the much bigger gain that we have from being able to pool our risk and share our rewards and vice versa with other parts of the UK. And to be honest, £150 million, even within the spending settlement of Wales, which is £15 billion, is relatively small potatoes. So we will need to deal with that. But actually, I think there are bigger games at play here, and we need to raise our eyes up and not point at the weeds all the time.
OK, that's enough for me. So I'll take a cluster of questions if I can. If you can introduce yourself, please, Sean.
Yes, my name's Sean Kyke. I'm a county councillor in Carmarthenshire, which is a nationalist area. But I've also worked and lived in Scotland for some years. In fact, I've made a couple of babies up there who are now grown up. I think there's a big difference between Wales and Scotland. When I go up to Scotland, people say, oh, you're just like us. We're not. You know, we actually, it's not just the Barnett formula. I think it's a lot of things have been under-resourced for a long time. And when I came back, I worked in the health service as a doctor. When I came back to Wales, it was startling because I'd been in Scotland for 6 years.
So
when I came back to Wales, it was startling because I'd been in Scotland for 6 years, in the mid-90s this was, and you know, we were under-resourced. We had, you know, a lot less. And I think we don't have the political clout because I think we appear to be more content. And that's what's actually, I think, I think someone in Scotland would say, well, the Barnett funding isn't enough for us, you know, relative to various others. I think we shouldn't argue about the Barnett formula, but I think we've had less for a long time. And also, because of our history, we're less self-confident about it. You know, I think we, you know, basically we've had a rather oppressive system for a much longer time, a few hundred years longer. We didn't join up supposedly, you know, with both sides agreeing. And I think that there is a difference, but I think this is a big problem, because I think you've talked about asymmetric devolution and asymmetric federation. And I find it very difficult. You know, we're not some German lander. We're not areas of roughly the same populations, whatever, unless you actually get federation within the UK. And personally, up in Scotland, you're right, everybody is talking about it. I'm actually a member of the SNP, possibly the only one in this room, but I've got my yes badge out, and now I've found that they're allowed. And but basically, you know, there is this terrific and wonderful debate going on in Scotland, which, you know, as you say, every pub, everywhere you go, every...
You know, question, please, yeah, honestly.
But the question is, how do we get rid of this asymmetric difference between... It's all very well saying, well, we'll all be together, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. How do we get rid of the asymmetry? And, you know, it's not a personal conflict, but it is conflict is caused by that, because it is divide and rule.
OK, thank you. See of hands. I'll take a few. Cathy.
Hi, Margaret, I read the Commission's report as well, found it really interesting. The suggestion about devolving housing benefits and unemployment and training, the work programme in particular, I think sounds a really good prospect for Wales, actually, because it already sits very well with what we already do. Whereas here, for some reason, we seem to be focused on discussing policing being the next step. It seems to me the housing benefit and the work programme is a bit more of a sort of labour issue, more important to quite a lot of us in terms of supporting people here. And I just wondered how you got to that point.
Okay,
let me.
And Owen,
okay,
could you put that on the list, please?
Okay, let me take one more and then we'll have an answer. Peter had his hand up first. Would you introduce yourself, please, Peter?
Peter Price, Chair of Cymru and Waleri. In the way that you were presenting, if I may say, Margaret, your case about the Scottish referendum, you were talking about this being decisive, even if it was a one vote, no vote. Now, isn't the problem that the three largest parties that are within the no campaign haven't come up with a single formula, an agreed formula, as to how they would take devolution forward? And indeed, only one of them published ideas a long time ago. The other two, the two largest, have only done so in recent weeks. And Labour have moved from their interim report to the final report, rowing back pretty considerably. How would you, assuming there is a no vote, how would you take it forward in the subsequent weeks? You've mentioned a Queen's speech. Are you saying, right, if we had a Labour majority, it would be just up to us, we would say, or would you go for some kind of attempt in some framework to get agreement between the major parties?
Okay, there's appetite for more questions. If you can keep the answers reasonably short, that'd be great.
It's very hard because they're quite substantial questions and I really would want to talk to you about them. And I'll try and work through. I might not do justice to them if I've got to speed up then. And I'm Glaswegian, I talk very quickly. So, but my Celtic cousins will appreciate that, won't they? I suppose I just don't agree with that kind of frame either. A part of why we said what we said about asymmetrical devolution is I think sometimes, and with the greatest respect to any constitutionalists that are here or MD in the academic field of that, we're so desperate to get a neat, tidy solution that sometimes we don't go for the practical thing that really works, because sometimes I think it works in practice, it will make governance better, it will produce better results, and it might just not be tidy enough for other people. Because as someone who argued for devolution all my life, if we'd waited till we got it absolutely right, and we'd never have got there, we'd never have come up with a system. And we're different countries. And we have to understand and respect that we're different countries, we're different sizes, and we've got different histories and different arrangements. Like policing's very much a different story in Wales than it is in Scotland. We've got our distinct judicial system, which is inherent in the Act of Union. The church, the protection of the church, protection of the education system, is a great issue of moment to Scotland. We would never want that to change and never have. But that doesn't mean to say that, you know, so I would live with the difference. I think the difference is great. and I think it leads to pluralism within Britain. I say it in Scotland very time. In fact, it was the Welsh Labour government that gave you free prescriptions first in the United Kingdom. The SNP try not to remind us of that sometimes, but that's for another subject. But I like that pluralism. Perhaps you don't. You know, that's maybe just a different political perspective that we have. In terms of housing benefit, I mean, again, this was, it's the logic of devolution at the beginning because of the integrity of the welfare state. And there is a sense across Scotland that we believe, and the polls show categorically that Scots believe, That sense of rights and entitlement, and that's what Brown was talking about when he talked about that equity across, you know, the different nations and regions. It's that sense of rights and entitlement, a levelling up across the union rather than a race to the bottom, that's a real sense of that we want to protect the welfare state. But as housing policy has evolved, we're now of a view that you could actually do that with housing benefit without disaggregating the welfare state, essentially. And the same with employment law. It makes sense to align that with local labour markets. And we've got a system that we think that will work, that still won't undercut the benefits that Scotland gets, particularly as disproportionately we get more in benefit payments as well. We don't think that will undercut that. So that's why we came to that. And again, very much driven by the politics of the devolution, not the constitutional dimensions of the devolution settlement. What works, what makes things better, what speaks to that kind of national priority that we want. That's our national, you know, view of what should happen here, rather than how does this ricochet across other things. That was the drive behind it. Which takes me on to Peter's point. And, Quebec had their referendum with a very narrow margin. They decided to stay within the rest of Canada. I think it was 0.5% of the vote went no rather than yes. And now the party that says let's have another one has just been wiped out of the last election. So I think it can be decisive, even if it's the margin. I think the history of referendums show you that it can be. People have to accept that.
That's an encouraging example.
And
an optimistic one,
anyway. That separatist voice will always be there in Scotland. I don't think the separatists will say, all right, okay, game's up, and I'm away in a corner and I'll shut up forever. I don't anticipate that, but they'll have to accept the lost. You know, if you're in this game, you win, you lose, and you just have to go with the verdict to the people, whether you like it or not, you just have to. And to us, devolution and separation are entirely different journeys. They are almost one against the other. If you're a devolutionist, you believe in empowering national institutions, but you still want to work in partnership. If you're a separatist, you believe in independence, you think that's fallacy. That's just wrong. That won't work because that sharing will never work to your national interests. So there are different perspectives, and you have to choose one or the other. And I think that it can be evolved. Now, I don't think it's a weakness or a surprise that different political parties have different perspectives on how they want to develop devolution. You know, the big story in Scotland is that the Tories are now there and that they've come to that. That's really probably the big game changer. But it's not a surprise that we've not come up with a single formula, nor does it remotely, I think, question the Labour's commitment to devolution. The fact that we haven't said to the Tories, let's do a deal on devolution, doesn't undermine at all. In fact, one of the interesting things about the debate we're having in Scotland, as you know, the Better Together campaign has got the UK parties all in it together, and we keep getting slated by people. How could you work with the Tories? How could you work with them? And then the same people say, why have you not worked with them to develop a programme of devolution for after? So there's a wee bit of an inconsistency in some of the arguments that have been put. But I have no hesitation. People agree with me in something, no matter where they're from, and I can help pass it, I'll work with them. That's not a problem. But what people now know is there is an absolute guarantee if they vote Labour and there's a Labour government, we will pass a Scotland Act as outlined in our commission, and those powers will come. That's what people know.
Okay, Owen?
On Sian's point, I mean, Sian, I just don't accept your perspective at all. I don't accept that we are not a confident nation. I, you know, refute that with every fibre of my being. I think in arts, in sport, in politics, in business, in every sphere of human activity, the Welsh have been leaders and standard bearers in Britain and across the world for a long, long time. And given that we are a country of 3 million people, I think we've punched well above our weight. So the notion we're not confident, I've never bought. I don't really buy the notion that we've got dramatically more confidence since devolution, frankly. I think that's a bit of an ahistoric perspective. I think the other thing I don't buy the notion that we're oppressed or done down or that sort of frame of grievance, if you like. Just don't think it's accurate or a reflection of our reality or our history. I think we've been one of the motors of Britain for a long, long period, but we share the perspective and the frame, if you like, of other post-industrial parts of Britain, and deindustrialisation has hit us massively harder than it's hit many of the less industrialised parts of Britain and the parts of Britain that relied more on trade and mercantilism historically than we did. You know, how do we address that? You know, it isn't about... This is why I say earlier on that I think some of the debate about Barnett is kind of, you know, second-order stuff. Because it won't be fixed with tax and transfer, especially not when the whole pie is getting smaller. You know, twiddling with Barnett will not see, a Damascene conversion of the Welsh economy into this, you know, great flourishing... forward-thinking economy. We do share the problems of the North East and elsewhere, and actually the way in which we change Wales is growing our economy in Wales, generating greater wealth, greater opportunity and jobs, and that does require partnership. It does require a London government that I think has got a really active industrial strategy working in partnership with a Labour government in Wales to push jobs other parts of the world. Cathy, I think we should be looking, and I think we will be looking at ways in which work programme in particular might be devolved to Wales. We've already said that that's something we will look at in respect of English decentralisation and devolution. I think economic regeneration funds, other things that have sat at the centre, we need to be thinking about how we push those out into the regions of Britain.
And housing benefits specifically?
Housing benefit, I think, is... Well, ultimately, you know, the reason it isn't being debated is Silk didn't recommend it. If Silk had recommended it, we'd be discussing it right now, but Silk and the Assembly hasn't asked for it. In Scotland, they did ask for it. You could argue that's a smarter choice by the Welsh Assembly, because it's not necessarily a net benefit to have housing benefit devolve. Work programme, I think, absolutely, because work programme working alongside Jobs Growth Wales is a bit messy, and I think it could be better. But housing benefit, you know, it might be good, might not be.
Okay, another round of questions. Okay, so John, I think you had your hand up first. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Sorry, George. Before coming to this afternoon, I thought I'd read a little bit about the Irish question. I think that would be of historic relevance. And because at the time of the Irish question, the Liberal leader, who was Welsh, was in favour of Home Rule. And the first Labour MP who was elected to a Welsh constituency was also in favour of Home Rule all round, and that was Home Rule all round within the Union. And although I'm a Labour man myself, I think that was probably the last time the Labour Party was on the front foot in terms of devolution. Since then we've been reactive and spent quite a lot of time forgetting that we were once in favour of Home Rule. But the Irish, although they had their Home Rule eventually, Michael Collins argued that you had to have socialism within one state because they'd be ruled by the British economy. And he was right. I don't think he was right about the socialism in one state, but he certainly was right about being ruled by the British economy. And it wasn't until they joined the European Union that their economy started to go up, although it bumped a little bit after that. But a consistent position from the Labour Party would be a great thing. But the Labour Party would recognise that, like Michael Collins recognised, just because you've got political independence, it doesn't mean that you're not dependent on the way that the economy runs in Northwest Europe, and that things like London are a huge elephant there, fact, and you've got to work with them. And I don't think the political independence is independent in reality. And in reality, we have to work with an economy which will always be very, very strongly linked to what happens 150 miles down the M4.
Okay, thank you. Elaine, if you can just introduce yourself.
Yes, Elaine Moore. I'm not a journalist, Owen, and I refute utterly the notion that I'm a member of the chattering class. However, since you raised the issue...
I'll do a social think on you now in a minute and find out. We'll test whether you are a member of the chattering class.
Since you raised
that was a joke,
issue,
by the way.
Yes, notice, however, that I'm not laughing.
No, I can tell.
Well, this is going well.
Yes, if I could ask my question.
Yeah, please do.
Please do. Please do.
Margaret, since you raised the issue of the 2007 economic crash, could you perhaps explain to us why we should be any more confident of Labour's response, given that you were in power at the time and failed utterly to regulate the financial institutions to the benefit of a united kingdom? And I would like to hear from Margaret, given Scotland's much stronger tradition in terms of its financial institutions, how your new Scottish... bill or
Scotland Act.
Yes, Act would enable Scotland to be able to resist the utter disregard of our financial institutions for the well-being of the nation, united or not.
Okay, thank you.
I'm David Caddock, just devolution campaigner and constitutional geek.
Self-confessed, I'm a chattering class member.
He asked Margaret Curran whether she would support Cameron Jones's calls, which we heard once again last night in the meeting, for a general constitutional convention, which touches upon some of the issues that Owen has mentioned as well. It's not just our relation with the centre, but the general the issues of parity, and indeed perhaps the voice for England that might be given. And by the way, John Major has come out today in support of Cameron Jones's call.
No, he's pipped right off now.
Cameron Jones came out in support of my call for a constitution. If I can be so immodest.
I think it's the one where they're encouraging long questions and long answers. So my confidence in getting another round in is low. So is there any final questions before we wrap up? So I'll take two more and then we'll have some closing remarks.
Robert Bryn Jones, IWA member. Well, that makes me a member of the chattering class. Couldn't care really. You mentioned about financial regulation. You said, well, what about a small country like Wales? Couldn't really do financial regulation. Hence we need the union, but actually really it's the European Union is now taking control of financial regulation, and what's happening in Westminster is that the Conservatives are fighting the best interest of the city to retain as much independence as they can from European regulation. So actually European Union hasn't been mentioned much in this discussion, but it's actually crucial, and it's to some extent also another pressure on the union, the United Kingdom, in that it's kind of taking over areas that used to be its preserve. So what is your comment on that?
Okay, I'll be a soft touch. I'll take two and then we'll have a final conclusion. So, gentlemen.
I'm Dusty Kennedy. I'm the head of Youth Justice Board in Wales, YJB Cymru. I was just wondering if you could give any thoughts on part of SILT recommendations, not specifically around policing, but youth justice. There are four very short paragraphs in there. So.
Okay, I'm conscious we've got some meaty questions to be answered here. So, John at the back.
John Antoniazzi, I probably won't ask a meaty question. So, you're elected in the next year. You're sitting around the cabinet table, and you're planning a very busy legislative programme. How are you both respectively going to make the case to actually get it fitted in to what will no doubt be quite a busy parliament? You know, particularly when we've seen the current Wales bill pushed to the back of this current parliament, and as an afterthought, it appears. So, comments on that, really?
That's a proper political angle question on a legislative timetable. You can't get more anarchy than that. Splendid.
Practically zipped up.
Okay, Owen, do you want to go first?
Yeah. Okay. John, I think the point you were making is that illustrates to an extent what I was saying, that, you know, we've got a reality in Britain of our actually peculiar. You said in northwestern Europe this is the way in which things are. It's not quite true, because Britain is utterly peculiar in having such massive divergence between the economy of the capital city and the peripheral economies. I mean, the gap between West Wales and the Valleys and London is greater than the gap in output that in any other OECD country. And frankly, the next Labour government has to have as one of its massive priorities, in my view, probably the predominant priority, reducing that gap, because that is about reducing inequality between individuals, and we do that in part by reducing inequality between regions. That's the reality we've got to deal with. My point is, I think we best deal with that not by isolating ourselves from London, but seeking greater influence there. But we do need to redress the economic strategy. There's no question about that, because we have not had an active enough, interventionist enough industrial strategy. It takes me to Elaine's point. Elaine, frankly, I am a self-confessed member of the chattering class. I'm chattering here tonight, as I always do. Mm-hmm. So it was no slight intended in, you know, I wasn't castigating the chattering class. It was merely referring to the fact that actually in Wales, unlike in Scotland, constitutional reform is not the principal topic of conversation around the breakfast table or indeed in the pub. But, you know, I think the point about maybe in your house.
In your pub.
I think you've just demonstrated that you are a member of those chattering classes. But I think the point you make about the banks is well made. And, you know, frankly, we've conceded, haven't we, long since, that there was insufficient regulation of the banks and there wasn't sufficient oversight. And I think the last Labour government, you did buy into an orthodox established perspective on the economy that, you know, free market, flexible labour forces, the city acting as a real driver of our economy and service sector acting as a driver of our economy was a modern way to go about things. And we, frankly, I think were wrong to assume that was the case, because quite evidently the crash occurred and there was more that could have been done by successive governments, I think, to foresee and mitigate against that. You know, the fact that we've conceded that is the one real reason why you should have some faith that we will fix it. Because nobody else, well, I've just said, I think we would seek to fix it through greater regulation and through the sort of active industrial strategy that would supplant concentration on the city and reliance on the city. Last two very points. EU, completely agree. I think you know, it is the gap in the conversation about the constitution in Britain. But to be honest, the EU and the way in which it stepped up the plate on some things, you know, lots of the good things we've got in terms of social regulation, social legislation in Britain, actually started in the EU under Labour and Tories. And it's an illustration of the ways in which we want greater collaboration, is why we are, you know, very, very clear that we think our interests are best served by being part of that union as well as the UK union. It complicates things, but I think both are necessary. Youth justice, I agree. I think it's one of the less controversial things. I think the other question, broader question of the justice system per se, is a really massive question that sometimes is glibly talked about. You know, we haven't had a separate police force or a separate judiciary in Wales ever. You know, ever since these things have existed, they've been in concert with England. You know, we are not Scotland on that, unless you want to go back to Howel of Thar, but I don't recommend that we do that today. And how do we prioritise things? Well, I'm simply going to play Ed Miliband a tape of him at Llandudno's Labour conference last year, saying that he would legislate in the first Queen's speech for to deal with issues related to Wales. And I'll have it on a loop every time he threatens not to.
Margaret.
And I could get the one he said at the Scottish conference, the same thing, so I can play it on a loop too.
Yeah.
And
digital revolution.
And I have every, honestly, hand on heart, every confidence and our ability to make sure that's in that first year's programme, mainly because it's been said, and it is a cast iron guarantee, and we believe
it. He's a devolver.
You know, it does actually. I mean, there is no worry about that. I'm sure of it. I'll maybe not try and cover everything, but maybe try and speak for them, because there's a few direct questions to me, and try and address those. And this will really annoy you, but I'm from an Irish background. I'm first generation, and I grew up with my family talking about the Irish question all my life. So I thought long and hard about it, and having lots of discussions with my family about it, and could go on at length about it. I do think that Scotland's relationship in the union is very different from Ireland's relationship in the union. But one parallel, which I think has got some bearing, I always remember my in our family discussions that we had, and I don't think we were chattering classes, I don't think you recalled of that, was my mother and her sisters always saying, the men want to sit and sing rebel songs over a drink all night. Do they think that actually is going to put food on the table? And there was that sense of that tension between romanticism, where you're over a drink, you play to the emotion, but actually, you may get hard-headed. This is about people's lives and how you really change people's lives. And I always had that sense of nationalism not being the answer to that, so that's part of it. But I do think the relationship with Ireland is very different. The economic and the governance relationship was very different. But that's a conversation I'm sure that could go on. I think maybe the deeper point you're making is that we need to also have an influence on the economy as well, and how you find that kind of relationship. And I know that, for example, 20% of jobs in Scotland come from firms that are outside Scotland or UK. I think largely English firms, maybe not completely English. Now, I would think in the interest of the people whose lives I want to change, I want to have some influence in that. I want to be able to have some kind of, you know, relationship where I can shift, I can have influence in how those companies behave and what they do, and make them grow, hopefully. So that's why I want to be part of the union. What's interesting about some of the debate about financial regulation in Scotland is we're a bit schizophrenic about it, because Alex Salmond was a great advocate of financial deregulation, in fact much more deregulation than we believed in, attacked Labour for being too much, you know, having too much financial control, and really encouraged the Royal Bank of Scotland to be, you know, resist government intervention. Now that tune's changed slightly. But the model for financial regulation that's based on the independent, the white paper that they proposed, actually curiously shares a degree. You need to have, you know, because the way these institutions work, you actually do need to have some shared arrangement about that. And I'm sure if we were independent, the first thing we would do is talk to Ed Balls or whomsoever about how we actually have a joint agreement. It's your point about we need to reconstitute some of that. But I take your point about, I think the world has learned, it's not just a British Labour Party point, about the power of these institutions and the governance we need to have about that, and how we come to terms with that. Partly that's European, but it's not completely European. Some of it's global and some of it's local. So I think there's a mixture of that. The direct question I was asked about the Constitutional Convention about Carwin, I'm not terribly sure what Carwin has said, so like a politician, well, I need to see exactly what he said. I mean, I've been through a lot of constitutional conventions. We'd have a lot of them in Scotland. The advantage is you get kind of cross-party agreement. You get corporate, you know, you get Civic Scotland talking with, you know, in a way that maybe they don't have a lot of space to be part of that conversation. So I see the advantage of that. But sometimes, you know, these are about laws and about how we actually change the laws. So you actually need the political parties to be focused about it and not just pass it over to other people. So I think that's part of it. But also sometimes I think, and I need to see what Carwin's actually saying, but I think sometimes we just search for a tidy solution. You know, that somewhere someone's got a plan in a drawer, or somebody, a clever person, will come up with something none of the rest of us have thought about sorting some of this out. And I just don't think that's possible. I think you need to be governed more by what you're trying to achieve and create the institutions that will allow you to do that. And I'm not always sure constitutional conventions get you there. But I wouldn't rule it out. I'm not saying that. I would need to see what it says.